Thank you. Thank you all. I hope you enjoyed your lunches. It's a great, as you know, as far as ballroom chicken goes, I think that that's about as good as it gets. So I hope you enjoyed it. So how about a hand for the staff helping everybody out today, huh? They're the ones that make it possible, and I appreciate all the help we got today. I've been up here quite a bit, but it's a real pleasure to introduce this panel. This one is great personal significance to me, and I think a lot of folks in this room probably share a similar story. My mother came from Cuba, and I think quite a few. My wife is Cuban. We have too many political prisoners in the family, and I think that's unfortunately too common a story in the Cuban community. But I think so. This is very personal. A lot of folks in the room, but I think everyone in this room, the rule of law is a personal subject to them. Something we take very seriously. And I think we all take President Reagan's adage on that you know, the rule of law is only ever safer. I'm totally misquoting it, but we've only, you know, it's only one generation away from extinction. And I think, you know, a lot of places, Cuba was a place where a lot of folks said it could never happen here. And then it did. And I think it's for a lot of very maybe obvious reasons, this is a very timely topic. And I want to thank the Federalist Society, Gene Meyer, Lisa Zell, for giving us this opportunity to have this panel. And I hope you will enjoy it tremendously. I have to say, while we were putting this panel together, the wish list, we thought we'd be lucky to get just one of these folks on this panel. And the fact that they were all willing to join us was just off the charts fortunate. So to our panelists and our moderator, I want to thank you. I'd also like to thank my panel co-coordinators, Harut Samra, Elena Crosby, Manny Farach. What you see before you today took a collective effort to pull off, and each of them played an instrumental role. So thanks to them. Speaking of instrumental roles, I'm proud to introduce today's moderator, Justice John D. Curiel. Justice Curiel is the 90th Justice of the Florida Supreme Court. Justice Curiel received his AB magna cum laude from Harvard College and his JD from Harvard Law School. He clerked for the Honorable John D. Bates of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia before joining Davis Polk and Wardwell, I always get that wrong, but hopefully I got it, in New York. His practice there included securities offerings, mergers and acquisitions, bankruptcy matters, and investigations. In 2009, he became an assistant United States attorney for the Southern District of Florida. He prosecuted hundreds of federal offenses, including international money laundering, public integrity, healthcare fraud, and human trafficking crimes. In 2013, he joined Cobra and Kim, where he specialized in cross-border disputes and investigations relating to financial products and services, with an emphasis on clients in Latin America. Of particular relevance to this panel, and one of the reasons we're very fortunate to have him moderate it, Justice Curiel, like myself, was born in Miami, and his parents immigrated from Cuba in the 1960s. His father, as one of approximately 14,000 unaccompanied minors, welcomed to the United States as part of Operation Pedro Pan. So I know this is a subject that's very much personal to him as well, and we're glad to have him. So ladies and gentlemen, a big, big, big round of applause for all of our panelists and Justice Curiel.
Thank you all very much. I it is hard for me to express how excited I am about the discussion we're about to have, because these are actual change agents in Cuba. And it is a truly spectacular thing that we have these folks together. It is, I would say, likelier than not that our discussion today will be heard in Cuba, will be discussed in Cuba, will be the subject of debate in Cuba. And to join colleagues at an event like this is always fun, always meaningful, but to participate in a discussion where there's a very high likelihood that it might actually extend some hope to people in Cuba about the rule of law is a privilege that I really can't even describe in how special this group is. Immediately to my left is Cristina Arriaga. She's a distinguished scholar and internationally recognized advocate for human rights, including with a special emphasis on the freedom of expression and freedom of religion. She served on the U.S. delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and was appointed by Congress to the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom. Her work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and Newsweek, and numerous scholarly publications. Ms. Arriaga also serves on the inaugural group of seven trustees who oversee Facebook's Oversight Board, an independent entity that makes binding decisions on content moderation for Meta's 2.9 billion users. The 20-member board includes Judge Michael McConnell and an incredible swath of folks from a variety of different legal backgrounds. So it's a real treat to have you here. Sitting next to her is my old friend, retired Ambassador Carlos Trujillo. I told him earlier today that whenever someone reminds me, what I currently do for a living, I immediately feel old. But I console myself with the fact that Carlos is a retired ambassador, which just makes him sound like a man of tremendous gravitas, and that he is. He is now a partner at Continental Strategy based in Washington, D.C., with offices in Miami. Prior to that, he was an extremely distinguished member of our bar here in Florida. He began his service to our community as an assistant state attorney. He founded his own law firm. He served as an extremely distinguished member of the Florida House of Representatives, and then President Donald Trump had the wisdom to nominate him to serve as our permanent representative to the Organization of American States. He was unanimously confirmed by the United States Senate and served with tremendous distinction and significance between March 30th, 2018 and January 20th of 2021. He was chair of the Permanent Council, the Budget Committee, and was very successful in the effort to reelect Secretary General Luis Almagro. President Trump also appointed him to serve as representative of the United States to the 72nd General Assembly of the UN under former Ambassador Nikki Haley. He was also nominated to serve as our Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, so an extremely distinguished public servant. Sitting next to Carlos is a hero of mine, Rosa Maria Paya. Rosa Maria Paya Acevedo is a Cuban democracy activist and human rights defender. In 2015, she founded the citizen initiative called Cuba Decide, or Cuba Decide, a movement in favor of changing the political and economic systems in Cuba. She's the daughter of the late Oswaldo Paya, a hero to many of us, the recipient of the European Parliament's Sakharov Prize, and two-time nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, who was killed by the regime in 2012. Rosa Maria is a graduate of the University of Havana, my grandfather's alma mater, with a degree in physics, and of the Global Competitive Leadership Program at Georgetown University. She is truly a legend in the cause of Cuban freedom. Sitting next to her is a man whose work has been the subject of tremendous attention in the last year, Mr. Alexander Otaola, whose channel on YouTube is as close as we have to a direct line to Cuba. And as we were just discussing, it was his work on YouTube that was so instrumental in getting people out on the street in the last year to protest and to give voice to the Patria y Vida movement. He is so influential. His show, Hola Otaola, is worth your time. It's informative, it's funny, it's satirical. It is lively, in a space where it is really risky to be lively. And I commend him for his work. And Jesus, I think, is going to help us translate some of our discussion today.
Yes.
So, all right, very good. Okay, so let's get to it. We've chosen as our topic for today, Cuba and the rule of law. And the reason this was so personally resonant for me is that, you know, at the Federalist Society, we're sort of used to discussing the rule of law and take for granted the foundational tenets of our constitutional democracy and republic. It becomes part of the environment, the air we breathe. We just sort of assume that, for example, contracts will be adhered to. And if we have a dispute about them, courts will resolve those disputes without respect to persons. Things that nobody in Cuba can take for granted. And those atmospherics influence the way daily life is lived. And so I thought we might start with one aspect of the rule of law, and that's criminal procedure. So I'd ask my panelists to consider a person, say an 18-year-old woman in Cuba, who today decides that she is going to protest Russian involvement in Ukraine and Cuba. And she makes a sign and takes it out on the street, and it says, Patria y Vida, freedom for Ukraine, freedom for Cuba. I would like for one of the panelists, maybe Rosa Maria, you can start this discussion, just to walk our audience through what would happen to that person. And I know that sounds sort of brute, because most of us, I think, can just imagine that that person would not have a very good day. But I think it would be constructive for me and for everyone just to hear what the experience of someone who actually voices an unapproved opinion in Cuba is, just step by step. What happens to that person? What does their family find out? What can that person expect to happen to them in the short term?
Yeah, well, is it just working?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Yes, I mean, sadly, there is no need for imagination. That happened in Cuba every day. That was exactly what happened to Luis Robles during Christmas 2020, and he's still in jail just because he went out into the street with a sign that read freedom for Cuba. He's still in prison. Jose Daniel Ferrer, leader of the opposition, he went out into the street with his son, just walked out from his house in the direction of a peaceful protest. He never got into the protest. He was arrested. He's still in jail. He has been tortured. Of course, he has not been, he has never seen a judge in front of him till today. And his family can only talk to him when the Cuban state security apparatus allow him to make that call that is going to long for maybe 5 minutes. But that has been the situation in Cuba for decades. And it is the situation still today. Even when probably many of you have heard or have been exposed to headlines that talk about some kind of changes in Cuba, that talks about a new constitution in Cuba, that talks about even a new president in Cuba, any of those terms, any of those concepts means the same for the Cuban people that it could mean for a citizen of a democratic country. There is not a president in Cuba, there is not a constitution in Cuba, there is not a rule of law in Cuba, and there is not a right to just step out into the street with a sign that says freedom or that says I'm hungry. It is irrelevant, the message. The thing is that if it is not part or it's not in line with the Communist Party propaganda, then you are probably end up in jail. And ending up in jail is not the worst thing that could happen to you. Dervis Laurencio was a young Cuban of African descent walking through the streets of Havana in the middle of a peaceful protest, chanting freedom with a cell phone in his hand. He was shot down in the back by the Cuban police. Nothing has happened till today. It's in a state of absolute impunity, and I'm not using absolute here in a light way. It's just the reality. Anything could happen to you if you are a subject of the Cuban totalitarian state, and especially in this moment, especially in during these days in which the Cuban people have been out into the streets demanding freedom. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but in July 11 last year, hundreds of thousands of Cubans went out into the streets demanding freedom in a peaceful protest. At least, because I said at least because that's what we could register, but probably were more, but at least 1,000 Cubans were in prison that day. At least 800 Cubans are still in prison. At least 500 sham trials have been made in Cuba till today. What is a sham trial in Cuba? It is a circus kind of day in which the defender, the prosecutor, the judge, everybody have to do what the Cuban Communist Party calls you to do. And right now, in my country, it means that children as young as 16 years old have been sentenced to 17, 20, 25 years in prison just for being part of that peaceful protest last July 11.
So given the tremendous stakes and the absence of predictability, the absence of rule of law, Alex, why does anybody do it? Why does anybody take to the streets? Why does anybody post on YouTube? What is it? And what do you say to them on your YouTube channel that motivates them to speak up given these risks?
The truth, only the truth. Thank you for having me here. I don't know, my English is terrible, I'm sorry.
No, aquí.
I need a translate. Thank you. Lo que pasa en Cuba ahora mismo es más allá de la verdad, más allá de lo que cualquier persona puede imaginar.
What is happening in Cuba right now is something that is beyond truth, more than any person could imagine.
La dictadura cubana, porque no puede definirse de otra manera que no sea una dictadura totalitaria, asesina y cruel.
The Cuban dictatorship, and that's what it is, it can't be defined as anything other than a totalitarian, assassinative state that is very cruel.
Ha cortado toda esperanza al pueblo cubano en estos 63 años.
It has cut all hope to the Cuban people in these last 63 years.
Ha dejado como única alternativa para tener una vida digna el emigrar.
The only alternative that it has left in order to have dignity in life is to emigrate.
Me gustaría rectificar ese término. Somos un pueblo desplazado, no somos un pueblo inmigrante.
I would like to clarify that term. We are a displaced population, not an immigrant population.
Los cubanos prefieren arriesgar su vida en las fronteras de Nicaragua, de Latinoamérica, morir en el estrecho de la Florida, a enfrentarse en las calles que les pertenecen a la dictadura totalitaria.
A Cuban would rather risk their lives on the border with Nicaragua and in Latin America and crossing the states of Florida, as opposed to coming head to head with the Cuban regime in the streets that belong to them in Cuba.
Ahora mismo, me gustaría contarles a todos ustedes que son abogados y que tienen una relación directa con las leyes, que la dictadura pretende impulsar el artículo 143, un artículo donde cualquier cubano de la isla que reciba algún tipo de ayuda humanitaria, algún tipo de ayuda para poder sobrevivir en un país miserable como han convertido a la isla cubana, los comunistas, esas personas que reciban ayuda pueden ser llevadas a la cárcel entre 5 y 10 años.
And I would like to tell you, a group of lawyers that are familiar with the rule of law, that the Cuban government is pretending to pass a project of law, Article 143, that provides that any Cuban that gets help, any humanitarian help, to facilitate the miserable conditions in which they live, faces the possibility of being jailed between 5 and 10 years.
Esto para hacer que los periodistas independientes, los cubanos de la sociedad civil independiente que alzan la voz, pues tengan miedo y dejen de denunciar y dejen de ayudar a salvar al pueblo cubano.
And the point of this is so that civil society, journalists, people that are fighting for freedom in Cuba are afraid, they become afraid, and they stop trying to help the Cuban people achieve freedom and achieve democratic change.
Una madre que le envíe dinero para comer a su hijo salió a la calle el 11 de julio, puede ser considerado un sedicioso y puede ser llevado a la cárcel por solamente recibir $100 de su madre.
A mother that sends $100, for example, to her son who participated in the protests of July 11th is liable to being held as a seditionist and somebody that is a traitor to the Cuban government.
Eso está sucediendo ahora, en este minuto, mientras estamos aquí todos, y les agradezco muchísimo el incluir el tema de Cuba en este evento.
That is happening right now in Cuba as we sit here today, and I thank you very much for including this subject in your event.
Lo que hice para contestar la pregunta, lo que hice para impulsar a la gente a tomar las calles, fue mostrarles en un espejo la triste realidad que les ha tocado vivir, que han permitido todas las generaciones, todas nuestras generaciones, hemos permitido que llegue a este punto.
What I did to facilitate the Cuban people taking to the streets is to show them in a mirror the conditions that they were living in, to show them in a mirror all the decisions that the various generations had allowed to result in the current conditions in Cuba.
El comunismo trabaja de una manera muy sutil.
Communism works in a very subtle manner.
Llegan al poder, son populistas, prometen lo que la gente quiere escuchar, y luego, cuando la gente empieza a pensar por sí mismo, se convierten en sus enemigos.
Communism works in a very subtle manner. First, they get into power. Then they become populists. They tell the people what they want to hear. And when they're fully entrenched, they take over people's lives.
Los cubanos de la isla permitimos que se nos fueran arrebatando uno a uno nuestros derechos. Derechos de movimiento, derechos de poder expresarse libremente, derechos de salir a la calle, derechos de viajar, derechos de relacionarnos, de invertir en nuestro propio país. Todo esto la dictadura lo fue quitando minuto a minuto. Creo que eso les puede resultar familiar con lo que está sucediendo hoy.
We Cubans allowed our government to take our rights away one by one. The right to movement, the right to free expression, the right to travel, the right to invest. One by one, they took them away from us until we had nothing. And that might remind you all a lot of something that is going on in this country right now.
Por eso es importante que reconozcamos el comunismo. Yo me siento profundamente comprometido con este país porque hoy es mi país. Me ha abierto las puertas y me ha permitido ayudar a los míos, a clamar por la libertad de los míos.
That's why I feel very committed to helping this country, because it has taken me in and it has helped me fight for liberty in my country, and I feel very committed to the cause of democracy in this country as well.
Por eso mi compromiso con este país también es advertirle a todos ustedes que el comunismo cubano es un cáncer que tiene el tumor central en La Habana, pero su metástasis está en toda Latinoamérica, está en Europa, y lamentablemente, también aquí.
That's why I'm committed to sharing with all of you in this country, to which I've committed, that Cuban communism is a cancer. It's a cancer that is metastasizing and spreading through all of Latin America. It's spread to Europe, and it's also here in the United States.
Yo traje, si me permiten, un código QR, que les pido que puedan escanear Aquí hay información adicional, imágenes, denuncias de padres de presos políticos, denuncias y sentencias de los tribunales que hoy pretenden juzgar a un niño de 17 años, a 55 niños menores de 18 años, pretenden juzgarlos a largas condenas por solamente tomar las calles y tratar de recuperar esos derechos que día a día permitimos que nos arrebataran.
And I've shared with all of you QR codes that will lead you to links that will show pictures and informations and judicial documents that in Cuba right now there are minors as young as 17 years old and younger, many of them who participated in protests, that all they asked for was for freedom and democracy in Cuba, peaceful protests, and are now facing very, very long prison sentences because they had the temerity to fight for their rights, the same rights that are now being taken away from all of us one by one in this country.
Solo hice mostrarle su vida, solo hice compararles su vida con el resto del mundo.
The only thing I did was to show them their lives, to show them how their lives are, and to compare it to how free people live in the rest of the world.
Y los cubanos, en un ataque positivo, espontáneo, de patriotismo, de civismo, decidieron tomar las calles para gritar freedom for Cuba, no more communism.
And when I did that, the Cubans spontaneously decided out of their own volition to come out to the streets, and to protest and to yell freedom for Cuba, no more communism.
Gracias.
Thank you.
So given what Alex Otaola has shared with us, Ambassador Trujillo, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the regional environment, even if Cuba isn't subject to any predictable rule of law domestically. There is an international community and an international rule of law with which you're probably more familiar than anyone in the United States. I wonder if you could speak to the international rule of law that predominates in our hemisphere and what can be done to address some of the concerns that Mr. Otaola and Ms. Paya have shared with us.
Thank you, John. And it's an honor to be here on this panel with this distinguished group. And I think as Americans, we often reflect, how does this affect me? And I think it's a serious question. There's bad things that happen all over the world. There isn't a single continent in this hemisphere world that doesn't have tragedy going on, from what's happening in communist China to sub-Saharan Africa to even our own hemisphere. So why should we care? Why is Cuba, this small little island of 12 million people, 90 miles from our coast, why is this important to our sovereignty and to our country? And I think it's very important to reflect on that and Cuba's role in the international world. How do we attack it? How do we accept it? How do we deal with it? And having worked in the last administration and really reflecting on the policies of the prior one before that, the approach is never to acquiesce. I think the approach of acquiescing, as we saw during the Obama years, if we are nice to them, they will be nice to us, was a terrible approach, and we saw the consequences. And how do those consequences affect our safety, our security, our sovereignty? That money that we sent as American taxpayers down to communist Cuba was not used to better the lives of the Cuban people. It was used to send soldiers to Venezuela to further destabilize it, to send 4 million migrants from Venezuela into Colombia, further destabilizing our strongest ally in the entire southern hemisphere, to further send 50,000 troops to Nicaragua with the same money we sent to Cuba was laundered, to send sharpshooters to kill protesters in Nicaragua, to send people to attack the Congress in Honduras and in Guatemala, to send people to burn down the subway systems in Chile. These things are not coincidences. They're all planned, they're all organized, and they're all run by the communist Cuban dictatorship. And unfortunately, a lot of the political power and economic power that they received was courtesy of the American taxpayer. When American cruise lines are able to go down there, when tourists are able to spend cash, they're not contracting with private enterprise. They're contracting with the Communist Party or the military. And that money is further used to oppress, kill, and torture some civilians across the Western Hemisphere, some of the children that Alejandro was asking about. So as lawyers, how does it affect the rule of law? Well, if you represent a multinational company in Venezuela, if anyone here has, how has that gone? If you're working right now in Colombia, are you scared about the upcoming elections with Petro? If you're doing real estate work in Miami, have you seen the massive influx of capital coming from Peru and from Chile? If you've done anything in Central America and you're seeing all the migrants coming up the coast, a lot of them traversing through Cuban military controlled territory. So the entire hemisphere is interrelated. And ultimately, what is the end game, right? The end game for the Cubans is control, it's dominance, it's imposing their totalitarian views across the hemisphere. And for them, as Alejandro said, being the mind that controls that body. And we see it in Miami-Dade County when you see massive Medicare fraud rings or truck fraud rings or every single imaginable fraud ring that's happening. These people don't just show up and all of a sudden decide to open up their clinics. They're trained, they're educated, they understand the American system. And that's from the criminal element. If you look at it just from a societal element, a lot, and I don't say this lightly, a lot of some of the Cubans that are coming now who are trained by the regime, their goal is to influence and capture audiences, just like the Chinese do it, just like the Russians do it. It's no longer the frontal warfare of, you know, person versus person. The new warfare is capturing ideas and questioning democracy across our hemisphere and across the world. Why does democracy work? Isn't the Chinese system better? Don't they have better education, better health care, better economic outcomes? Isn't it more just that everyone is treated equally? And these are the debates that they start to plant all across the hemisphere and all across the world. And ultimately, unfortunately, there is extreme poverty. There's a lot of people who live in terrible places. And they think things cannot get any worse. Why don't I just take up this handout? You know, it's better to have something than to have nothing. And ultimately, we end up in the same place that, as Alejandro and Rosa Maria has said, they take away every single right you possibly have. So I think it's very important, as you know, we reflect in as Americans and as lawyers on why is this important to me? Why is this important to my state? Why is this important to my country? And our behaviors, like all actions, have consequences. And I think it's very, very important, not only with Cuba, but with China and some other countries that we're very, very soft with, that our economic decisions, our political decisions, our foreign policy decisions resonate in eternity for some of these countries.
Thank you, Ambassador Trujillo. I'm wondering, Cristina, given the discussion of how central free expression is to progressing the rule of law in Cuba, if you could tell us a little bit about the role of social media in driving the political reform in Cuba. And the reason I sort of focus on that is because it seems to me that the rule of law, such as it is online, is more than sort of a Cuban user of the internet could expect from his or her government. As imperfect as it may be from the standpoint of a US user of a Twitter or a Facebook or a TikTok, it is a free space, comparatively speaking, for the Cubans who are able to access it. And so I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about your work in this area and what role you think social media might have in promoting the rule of law in Cuba.
Thank you very much. Is that working?
I think so. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Of course, we Cubans, someone goes, get closer immediately. So how many of you are of Cuban-American descent? Okay, quite a bit of us. You've been very quiet for a Cuban, I have to say. First of all, thank you. It's so nice to be with my people, because working as a trustee on the oversight board for Facebook, I am sure they're surprised I didn't show up the first day with a cigarette and a handgun to our first meeting. They have quite the cartoon version of conservatives, let alone of Cuban Americans. So it's been a terrific privilege to be here for 2 days after coming in from the People's Republic of Alexandria, Virginia. So thank you. So I'd love to talk a little bit about social media, but I would also like to tell you a little bit about what the everyday Cuban life is about, because I have a lot of friends who go, hey, I was in Cuba, I saw Varadero, it was beautiful. I went to a store, they had everything in the store. You Cubans exaggerate all the time. You know, it is true, we Cubans exaggerate about a lot of things. We're proud of things like the first hijacked airplane, a Cuban. You know, we're sort of proud of that. Who invented Coca-Cola? A Cuban. Gatorade. I talked to the person, Gatorade, you see, it was a Cuban. You see, you can talk a lot about Cubans. Well, regrettably, we also invented a horrible way to implement communism, as Alexander was talking about. So when you go to Cuba, you will see a Cuba that Cubans never see. It's like apartheid in South Africa, but executed with brilliant PR skills. So this is the average life, the average salary of a Cuban is $163 per month. But in reality, if you went to school and you trained as a dentist, it's probably $20 to $40 per month. What is your life like as a dentist? And this morning I was talking to a Catholic priest whose sister is a dentist, and this is what happens. You go into your office, you don't have gloves, you don't have suture equipment, you don't have anything to do fillings with. This is a country that's exporting slave doctors to other countries, pays them $20 a month, and then other countries pay the Cuban communist regime what a normal wage would be. What else happens? You get home, and to buy a small container of orange juice, one you would buy at Walgreens for $1.63, you pay $7. So the sister of the priest who's a doctor, you know what she does? She goes home and she makes a pound cake, and she walks around the neighborhood selling slices so she can feed her children. Because the dollar economy, access to those dollars, you have if you get money from your relatives in the United States, which may now cause you to go to prison, or you go to the black market. A lot of people say, well, Christina, you know, it would be so nice to open a business there. Why don't you do that? There must be a lot of opportunities. What happens when you open a business? Well, the 2019 Constitution, the West bought that there were all these great economic changes. Cubans are now allowed to have certain small businesses, doing people's nails, having a small bakery. But if you're a lawyer, or you're in the medical field, or you're a contractor for construction equipment, or you're an architect, you have to work for the government on a government wage. It's illegal for you to do any work in the black market. So what happens if you want to open a bakery to feed your family? Well, the government will watch to make sure that you're abiding by government rules. So you can buy 2 pounds of sugar from the government store, but in reality, you know, we Cubans are sneaky. So we'll have a receipt for one, but in reality, we bought 5. And then we start our business. But let's say that I put a little sign on my door that says Freedom for Cuba or Black Lives Matter. Now, the Cuban regime is going to arrange to inspect my facilities and make sure all my receipts correspond to that inventory that I have, and eventually I will have to shut down my business. This doesn't make headlines in any newspaper, but this is the daily life of a Cuban. So the escape for many Cubans, if they have access to a cell phone, and they can go to a place where for an extraordinary amount of money, they could pay for Wi-Fi, social media. So Meta has a lot of problems it needs to fix. Are we on the record? Including why did they change their name? I will continue to call it Facebook. But I have to give some credit to Meta, because the only social media platform that has a human rights department and the only social media platform that has decided to invest $130 million into an independent entity that will make decisions that Facebook has pledged to obey. Is it perfect? I can tell you no. I have acid reflux at every meeting. However, what are the answers to regulate social media? when a black Cuban, what's his name, Roca, he streamed his arrest on Facebook. His name will come to me, 57, horrible. El que salió en New York Times. Denis Solis, okay. Denis Solis, a black Cuban rapper, he was rapping in favor of Trump. Granted, not a good idea to stream yourself rapping in favor of Trump. You know what's gonna happen. Even in this country could be a problem. So he was rapping in favor of Trump, and then he knew he was gonna get arrested, so he streamed his arrest on Facebook. That could not have happened. Every journalist in Cuba, every librarian in Cuba, has to work for the government. So the only way to circumvent that is to engage in social media. So my hope is that the oversight board and social media platforms will serve as a catalyzer, as you said, for freedom of expression. Judge Lerner Hand said, right, freedom lives in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution can save it. I know I paraphrase it, and for you, for those of you that know it by heart, it's one of my favorite. I mean, the Cuban constitution, the North Korean constitution, they all guarantee freedom of expression, but it's a strong culture of freedom of expression. And if social media platforms do their job right, and I cannot guarantee they will, but at least they have conservatives that serve on those panels, we may be able to serve as a catalyzer so that the Cuban people, among other countries, can experience the kinds of freedom that they don't experience in real life and build a culture around it, and then the law will follow. Thank you.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad you brought up the subject of constitutions, because I'd like, having been through some difficult conversations about current situation or the current reality of Cuba, I want to try and conclude our discussion on a more optimistic note by dreaming a little dream about what Cuba's next constitution, next government might look like. On the 4th of July of 1776, the Marquis de Lafayette was 18 years old. So was James Monroe. Aaron Burr and John Marshall were 20. Alexander Hamilton was 21. So far, the only person old enough to have had a mojito. Gouverneur Morris, who wrote the first magical 52 words of our Constitution, was 24. James Madison was 25. John Paul Jones, 28, would soon command the Bonham Richard and say, "I have not yet begun to fight." John Jay was 30. Thomas Jefferson was more complicated then at 33 than perhaps all of our subsequent presidents combined. Paul Revere made the midnight ride at the ripe old age of 40. And George Washington, the most consequential American, was 44. I turned 44 in a month. All of these folks are young. And it struck me 245 Julys later, as I watched the Patria y Vida protests in Havana, that we were looking at a constitutional generation in Cuba, that the young people of Cuba today will in their lifetime see change. And we as one of Cuba's neighbors, arguably its closest neighbor in terms of consanguinity and history, have a real interest in what Cuba's next constitution looks like and what form of government the Cuban people will choose. So my question, and this isn't to anyone on the panel individually, but hopefully everybody has a view on it and you can share it in whatever order you like, and hopefully in dialogue with each other, is who is at Cuba's constitutional convention? Who goes to write that constitution? Who's their Madison? Who's their Monroe? Who's their Jefferson? Who are the people who will be electable in a free Cuba? Who's running for office, and what political constituencies will they have to resonate with? Tell me a little bit, when you dream of Cuba's future, what it is you see.
I think we have two at the table, right? Alejandro, yes. Rosa Maria, yes. Would be hopefully at that table. And just like Alejandro Rosa Maria, throughout the 3 years I served in the government, the amount of brave, courageous Cubans that live on the island and that risk their hide every single day, it's humbling. You meet these people and they have everything to lose, and the only thing they have to gain is their freedom, and they don't take that for granted. So I think the future is bright for Cuba. There's so many people that the gig is up. There's no, you know, famous judge in Dade County, when you were seizing up to try your case, he goes, do you have chicken salad or chicken shit? And he goes, there's not enough mayonnaise. You can make chicken shit taste like chicken salad. And I think Cuba, it's the same thing. There's not enough propaganda. There's not enough spin. There's not enough anything left that your average 20-year-old Cuban who sees his cousin living in Miami, who has a car and has sneakers and is able to listen to music, thinks this is a better alternative to that one. So I think for Cuba, the future is bright. It's only a matter of time. The protests in July, it was spontaneous combustion. It wasn't one place at one person at one particular time. It was the entire island, unorganized and random. And the underlying issues of lack of opportunity, of oppression, of lack of physical goods, of food, of medicine, of housing, they still exist. If anything, they've gotten worse. So it's only a matter of time before the floodgates break, and hopefully Rosa Maria and Alejandro will be running the country.
Te toca, Rosa.
Rosa, it's your turn.
Okay. I have a list there that I could read for you with all the names that we prepare. No, I mean, yes, the future is bright. Yes, the July 11 protest was a very organic one, but I have my problems with the word spontaneous. I think that the Cuban people have been thinking on this liberation process and have been working for and towards that liberation for decades, to be honest. I mean, from the beginning of the dictatorship. And of course, we think a totalitarian regime is very difficult to get organized. It's very difficult to have a pre-constitutional discussion. Actually, several Cubans have tried, and they have succeeded, and they have spent time in jail also, have been expelled from the country. I think that the good news is the one that my dear friend, retired ambassador, just shared. The Cuban people wants freedom. The Cuban people is ready to grasp that freedom and to start to work in the transition process that, as all of you may know much better than I, much better than me, is something that is going to take time. It's a process that is going to need probably temporary laws for elect that constitutional conventions, laws to be able to pass through a transitional, some kind of transitional justice process. Laws to guarantee from the first day the most basic human rights that Cubans have been denied for 60 years, for 60 years right now, and then be able to have free, fair, and multi-party elections. The other news is that we have the experience, the possibility that have been given to us by the fact that we are now able to analyze what have happened and what have been going wrong with other transition process in Eastern Europe, in South America. And we have the real opportunity to become what the Cuban people have dreamed of and have actually built here in this country, a very modern, a very democratic and a very successful society. We have that capacity, but to get to that point, it's necessary to pass through the liberation process. And that's one that the Cuban people is actually demanding and working for right now while we are talking. And that people deserve and need the support of the international community, which in some degree is your support. In some degree is your words, your actions, pressuring the administration of the United States for them to do what is needed to do. Because the Cuban people already took the highest possible risk, their own lives, to be out in the streets demanding freedom, and they are still doing so. Protests in Cuba have been actually increasing during the last month. In the middle of the militarization of a whole island, I mean, in the middle of the state terrorism being applied in a very dramatic way, each day, the protests in Cuba are actually increasing. But we already learned, and we have learned that from Tiananmen Square till La Plaza de Caracas a few years ago, that 1 million people in the streets, yes, it's necessary, but it's not enough. You need actions from the international community. You need the democracies of the Americas partnering with that people in the streets in the demand for freedom. We need a world reaction. We need a world reaction to stop the impunity of the Cuban regime. We need the government of the United States taking the lead in that reaction. And not just because of the historical depth that this hemisphere have with the Cuban people, but because, as Ale and Carlos mentioned, because having tolerated the Cuban dictatorship for 60 years have been the end of the democracy in Nicaragua, the end of the democracy in Venezuela, the instability crisis in each country of this region, the drug dealer trafficking, the sanctuary for terrorists, not just Latin American terrorists, also North American terrorists living in Cuba, the gateway, the operators of the Chinese Communist Party and the Renew KGB, I don't even know the name, are the Cuban state regime intelligence services that, by the way, are much more influential, but by far in our region than the CIA. And that's a matter of national security for this country. Do not take my word. Just listen to the foreign vice minister of Russia. Just stating the fact that Putin has plans to deploy military troops in Cuba and in Venezuela if Biden just don't do whatever Putin wants him to do. By the way, they are already military troops in Venezuela. That already happened. And we have already lived through not one, not two, not three, at least five migratory crises provoked by the Cuban regime. And I'm not just counting the ones that have been sending Cubans and Cuban intelligence agents to this country. I'm also counting with the biggest migratory crisis of our time, the Venezuela migratory crisis, also provoked or co-provoked by the Cuban regime. So to partner with the Cuban people in this moment is the best decision. Is the best decision the American people and the American government could take for the sake of the American democracy.
But our founders at Lafayette, we need to be the Lafayette of the Cuban people. And this is how each one of you can do it. First of all, Congress has given us powerful tools in the Magnitsky Act. While Cubans are dying in the streets of Cuba, Caridad Diego, who's the head of the Communist Office of Religious Affairs, comes here to do her Christmas shopping in New York. The State Department and the Treasury Department could stop that from happening. I know President Trump, for instance, was able to sanction many of the financial industries that were funneling money to the military, funneling the money that a lady in Hialeah would send to her son, you know, the $70 that was... Part of that was going through the communist system. you as lawyers in your own practices can sieve through what the private companies are doing in terms of investment in Cuba. We haven't talked about what BlackRock is doing in each one of our states, a company that has the equivalent of half the GDP in investments and is investing in China, China investing in Cuba. Finding places where we can divest our investments from investments in Cuba. And regrettably, our own State Department, we were having a very lively conversation at the lunch table today about it. Our own US agencies have been duped at best into believing the Cuban propaganda machine. We have the imprimatur of the most powerful country in the world. Our reports are heard around the world. And when you become Schedule C's or political appointees during the next administration, we have to make sure that the civil career people that work with us, some of them are great patriotic people, but a lot of them are ideologically in the pocket of the Cuban regime. We experienced it when we were in government service, and there's a lot that can be done to support the Cuban people. I had the privilege, and this is the last thing I'll say, to work with Armando Valladares under President Reagan. I know I'm that old. Under President Reagan at the United Nations, what was called the Human Rights Commission. And I remember one time I met a woman who actually, her husband had been tortured in brutal ways that you can't even imagine. And his wife was able to visit him after 6 years of being in solitary, he had been in solitary confinement. And he was eventually released, and I said, how did you survive? You are naked, covered in excrement and urine. You are tortured. You are missing a hand. You're blind in one eye. What kept you alive? And he said, because Armando Valladares used to read lists of people who are in prison sometimes, and the U.S. delegation. And sometimes he was like John Adams, you know, Pepita Hernandez. I mean, they were just names. But at the time, no one cared. And he told me, my wife came to visit me in prison, and she whispered, I heard your name in Geneva. And that sustained him to 3 more years of solitary confinement. He knew he was not alone. Lifting the stories of people around you, supporting the Cuban people, and making sure that our international systems, our own State Department, our own United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, all of those agencies are aware, and they're taking names and they're lifting stories, is very powerful.
Me gustaría decir que la crisis que se está viviendo en la frontera norteamericana en este momento tiene que ver mucho con la mano del régimen cubano.
I would like to say that the crisis that this country is suffering right now at its southern border has a lot to do with the work of the Cuban government.
No sé si dominan ustedes el tema, y espero que sí. Nicaragua, otro país comunista con Ortega en la cabeza, donde están presos los opositores, los candidatos a la presidencia han sido procesados.
I don't know if you guys connect the dots that in Nicaragua, a communist regime with Daniel Ortega at its head, where presidential candidates are presently imprisoned.
Nicaragua aceptó darle visa abierta. No necesitan los cubanos visas para huir del comunismo y llegar a Nicaragua. Ese es el camino para llegar a la frontera sur de México.
The Nicaraguan government has said that Cubans don't need visas. They can leave the communist government in Cuba and go to Nicaragua, which is the first step in Central America on the way to the southern border.
Esto es una muestra de cuán afecta el régimen cubano la sociedad norteamericana.
This is an example of how the Cuban government affects U.S. society.
¿Cuánto poder pueden crear y desarrollar para desestabilizar la política de seguridad nacional de este país.
How much power they can create and harness to destabilize the national security of this country.
No se puede seguir viendo el problema de Cuba como una islita, no es mi problema, no me afecta, no conozco a ningún cubano, no soy cubano, no sé nada de Cuba.
You can't keep looking at the problem in Cuba in isolation as a small island only 90 miles away that has nothing to do with us, that it's there by itself because I don't know any Cubans and it's not my problem and it's not my country. You can't keep looking at it that way.
El objetivo de la dictadura cubana está centrado en las democracias del mundo. Fidel Castro tenía, y lo decía abiertamente, la idea de la Gran América, de unir todos los países, de que una misma ideología ridícula y miserable gobierne las almas de los pueblos.
The ambitions of the Cuban government are squarely centered in free democracies throughout the world. Fidel Castro used to say it, that he wanted to import his miserable regime to other free democracies throughout the Americas.
Esto es peligroso para Estados Unidos.
This is very dangerous for the United States.
Es muy peligroso para Estados Unidos y es hora que todos, toda la comunidad internacional pueda apoyar a la libertad del pueblo cubano. Con una Cuba libre, será libre todo el hemisferio de este cáncer maligno que se llama comunismo.
This is a very important message. You have to be aware that freedom in Cuba means freedom for the entire Western Hemisphere. If you get rid of that terrible regime in Cuba, you will guarantee the freedom of all of the free nations in the Western Hemisphere.
El comunismo en Cuba también se disfrazó de minorías.
Communism in Cuba also hid behind the shadows of small minorities.
También se disfrazó de justicia.
It also hid as justice.
La prueba demuestra, la historia demuestra, que no tiene nada de eso, sino todo lo contrario. Es hora que despertemos y es hora que le digamos todos, como pueblo, como nación, como amantes de la libertad, no a la dictadura cubana.
History has shown that the Cuban government was neither just nor was it a positive force for minorities on the island. It's time that all of us stand together as an international community and say that's enough to the Cuban government, that's enough. It's time to bring freedom and democracy to Cuba.
Thank you very much.
So on that wonderful note, I'd like to thank again Jesus Suarez for helping us all get the message and all of my wonderful panelists. For this great discussion and all of you for your attention this afternoon. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.